So after having had quite a mathematical week last week, this week we're going to look at sort of things that are a bit more physical. And coming on from what we did on Friday, I want to sort of pick up where we left off and carry on talking about black holes. So I know you've seen the Schwarzschild black hole. So we're going to start off with Schwarzschild, but I want to sort of perhaps discuss it in a slightly different way, maybe, from the way in which you first met Schwarzschild. So I think one of the key things about the black hole, the reason it's black is that nothing can come out of it. So the sort of main feature of black holes is actually their causal structure, because that is what is classifying the black hole, the idea that you've got this event horizon, this causal boundary that you can't see behind. It's not that the space doesn't continue behind the event horizon, it's just that we can't see it. So David tells me you've seen Kruskal coordinates, so I won't be sort of spend too long on the derivation. But what I'd like to start off by doing is by describing how you come up with a very compact way of encoding causal structure of black holes, and that is the Penrose diagram or Penrose-Carter diagram. And those are, that's the way you, essentially by drawing a picture, you kind of see what the relevant regions of space-time are for the black hole. So we'll start off with Schwarzschild, and then we'll sort of go on and talk a little bit about rotating black holes, because they're really the ones that are astrophysically relevant. Okay, so that's just a few words summarizing what I just said. So we'll start off by looking at the Schwarzschild metric, because that's a very clean one. And I'll sort of alternate between using 2GM and R+. So the idea, R+ is just shorter to write than 2GM, which is why I'm putting it there. But R+ is the event horizon. So our first step is, as you're probably aware, is to change our radial coordinate. So what we first do is we try and find a new radial coordinate such that finding light cone coordinates, in other words, the null coordinates of the space-time, is a bit easier. So we take the integral of dr over v, so that is our integral of one over one minus 2gm on r, and so our r star has a sort of logarithmic behavior that we don't really, it's very subdominant until we get near the event horizon. But for large r, r star is roughly r. So that corresponds to the idea that far away from our black hole, our radial coordinate is just a normal radial coordinate, and so null rays would look like T plus or minus R. But near the event horizon, we've kind of pushed our event horizon at R equals R plus off to minus infinity. So that's our, if we sort of look at our metric now, if I just put it in brackets, so this is a very natural coordinate to take from the perspective of finding the causal structure. So our light cones light rays, radial light rays obviously, are looking like T plus or minus R star is a constant. So the reason why we're so interested in light rays is, of course, they are what tells us about causal structure. We have this notion nothing can travel faster than light. So once we've characterized where light goes in a space-time, we know what our causal structure is. So that's the reason why we do this. So we then take our Kruskal coordinates. By looking, so you probably saw, you know, V is T minus R star, little u is T plus R star, and these are our Eddington-Finkelstein coordinates. So we exponentiate those to get our Kruskals. So the reason that we exponentiate them is because the sort of coordinate singularity, if we look at what's happening as we go to 2GM, as we go to 2GM, R star goes to minus infinity and V goes to zero. So, you know, our metric there in that I sort of put the sort of the initial terms of, that it's obviously a singularity to that metric. We know from our, you know, our sort of collective knowledge, it's a coordinate singularity, but the problem is that that's now happened at R star equals minus infinity. So we have to kind of go beyond that, and that's why we exponentiate our coordinates, because it then takes minus infinity to something equals zero. So if I take du dv here, I get a dt plus dr star and a dt minus dr star. So then I get my dt squared minus dr star squared, which is good because that's what's appearing in the metric. And then because these are exponentials, I just pick up a factor of uv. Minus sign. So that's what my du dv looks like. And then I work with that. So u times v, the t's, the exponentials of t's disappear. So I just get e to the r star over 2r plus twice. So that's my e to the r star over r plus. And then I look at what my r star is, and it's r star is r plus that log term. But I can see that this out front is just V. And so what I have is my Schwarzschild, or the beginning of my Schwarzschild metric, times a function of R, but a function of R that is not singular at R plus. So this is now a regular function of R, and the only problem point for this is R equals zero. So if I ask, I'm going to draw a picture in a moment, but if I ask what are the sort of key points of my these Kruskal coordinates, so obviously I want to be able to think about where my original Schwarzschild coordinates, what they correspond to. So I would be interested in what R equals constant lines are, what T equals constant lines are, where the horizon is, and of course the singularity at R equals zero. So if I ask what happens with R is constant, we saw that U times V was a function of R. So if R is constant, U times V is a constant. Similarly, if I want to pick out T, all I do is divide U by V. So if I want a T equals constant line, that's going to be U over V equals constant, or V over U. So next, the obvious thing is the event horizon. So here, this prefactor was U times V. So if I go to R equals R plus, I get zero because of that R minus R plus. So that tells me UV equals zero for the event horizon. And finally, as R goes to zero, then this factor here, that just becomes one. This just gives you a minus one. And so what that's telling you is that U times V is actually just R plus squared. Dry. A minute. Okay, so we conventionally sketch our U and V axes at 45 degrees, and that is because the U and V coordinates are related to light-like coordinates. So light travels at a speed of one in our world, and therefore we put our light cone at 45 degrees. So this is our V coordinate, this is our U coordinate, and then I simply look at what I just wrote down to try and see what the relevant sort of lines are. We see we get R equals constant lines are hyperbole. So this would be R equals constant. And then in this quadrant, R equals constant actually looks more like a T equals constant line. And our singularity is at uv equals r plus squared. But there are two of those, so I get another one down here. T equals constant is u is proportional to v. And then finally, my event horizon, my R plus, is this thing here. Hopefully that's familiar. So what this is telling us is that, as you probably already saw, these Kruskals take our Schwarzschild coordinates, our natural T and R coordinates, and extend them across the event horizon. So this tells us that the event horizon is only a coordinate singularity. The fact that our event horizon, R equals R plus, actually corresponds to lines at 45 degrees tells us that the event horizon is a null surface. So that's telling us it's a causal boundary because, you know, again, the speed of light is our limiting speed. We can't go faster than light, so we can't see beyond a light cone. So that's our Kruskal picture of the black hole. But what is the Penrose diagram? So the Penrose diagram basically takes this picture here, the UV coordinates, span the whole of the plane. So U and V run from minus infinity to infinity. But what the Penrose process does is it takes that picture and kind of squeezes it in to something compact. So you take your sort of infinite space-time and compactify it. And the way you do that is by, well, doing a sort of simple analytic function that takes an infinite range and sort of shrinks it down to a finite range. The way we do that is to take an arctangent. So the tangent function takes a finite range, minus pi on 2 to pi on 2, and blows it up to infinity. So we take the arctangent, and it reverses it. So for example, V tending to infinity corresponds to P going to pi on 2, with a similar thing for U. If V equals R plus, then we're looking at arctan 1, so P is pi on 4. And V equals 0 is P equals 0, with the same sort of statement for the U coordinate. So by having taken the arctangent, we've taken this V coordinate, and we've kind of scooched it down to a range from minus pi on 2 to pi on 2, and we've done the same thing in the u direction. So our p and q now run between minus pi on 2 and pi on 2. So if we just did this to the whole of the real plane, this is what we would get. We would shrink our real plane down into a diamond. So that's what we would have. So let's ask how much of that is actually physical space-time. Well, this is where we always live conventionally. So in this quarter of the plane, this is where if we go out to infinity, we just get flat space. We've just got T and R and things look like Minkowski space. So we can go off to V equals plus infinity, provided we stick to U less than zero. So that is our physical space-time. Is like that right-hand quadrant. So what that means is this is our space. All of that is part of our space-time. So now let's look at what happens, let's say in here, which is inside the event horizon. So in this particular case, we're looking at U being positive, and just for the sake of argument, we'll take the top quadrant, which is V is positive as well. So, sorry. Yeah. So in other words, what happens as R tends to zero? So previously, we saw that R equals zero was UV equaled R plus squared. So if I look at what UV equals R plus squared means, that tells me that tan P, tan Q equals 1, which tells me that sine P, sine Q equals cos P, cos Q, or cos of P plus Q equals 0. So that tells me that P plus Q is equal to plus or minus pi on 2. In other words, my singularity is this straight line here. And now I basically rub that out. And that is my Penrose diagram. This is the causal structure of our black hole. On a sheet of paper. So this is what you'll see when you see a picture of a black hole. So this is R equals zero. The light cone here is R equals 2gm, or R plus. And then we can ask, what are some of the other surfaces on that picture? What do they correspond to? Well, this point here, this is obviously as we go to infinity in our space-time, but let me draw. I'm going to make full use of the colors here. So if I look at what happens to my R equals constant and T equals constant lines under this transformation, the R equals constant lines look quite similar to what they looked before. T equals constant because we've shrunk everything down. These now sort of curve on our picture. So that red spot is something that's out at infinity, but we get to it along a T equals constant line. So this is spatial infinity. So that's one thing that we label. Then we could ask, okay, so that's what happens if I go to infinity at a constant time. What happens if I go to infinity at a constant radius? So in that case, what I would do is I would be going to infinity along one of these lines. So this is the infinity that we, well, not us personally, obviously, but that a time-like observer would see. And of course, there's one of those in the past as well. But that's not the only thing that happens at infinity. We've also got this whole surface here. So the purple, to get to the purple surface, I would have to go to infinity at 45 degrees or asymptotically at 45 degrees. And 45 degrees, we know, is a light ray. So this purple surface is called a null infinity. And just like before, we have a future and a past. And these are denoted by a script I, which is called scry. So people were kind of interested, the reason people are interested in sort of classifying what infinity is because typically when we're dealing with a black hole system, we'd like to know things about it, like its mass or its charge or its angular momentum. And so what that means, how do we define that? Well, I mean, if we have some isolated system, we can define it by going a long way away and then saying, well, you know, the mass is sort of essentially what it would be if you're in a linearized approximation to gravity. So the normal thing that we call mass, we kind of measure at this I naught. But sometimes we want to look at a mass that might change, in which case we measure a mass along this scry, because then that can actually change as radiation goes out to infinity. So I get, if you've been sort of following the story about black holes, black hole information, and what Stephen Hawking, Malcolm Perry, and Andy Stromager have been up to, they've been looking at this infinity and looking at transformations and charges that you can deduce on this infinity. So that's kind of where that's pointing towards. So this is our causal diagram of the black hole. And although we've derived it for Schwarzschild, we can also talk about causal structure of other space-times. So the other one that I think is worth just seeing is Minkowski space-time. Simply flat space in polar coordinates. Here, our V is simply T plus R. And our U is simply T minus R, because we don't have any coordinate singularities except the obvious ones that are associated with polar coordinates. We don't need to work very hard here. And our polar coordinates tell us that R is bigger than or equal to zero, which tell us that V is bigger than or equal to U. And so if I drew my UV coordinates again, What that tells me is I'm only looking at the right-hand side of the plane. I then do my Penrose transformation, my compactification. So in other words, I'm changing coordinates, changing my chart from U and V to P and Q. What I get is this little sort of flag looking thing. This is R equals zero. This is my I zero, I plus, I minus, scry minus, and scry plus. So that's my compactified Minkowski spacetime. So causally, it's extremely straightforward. If you're a time-like observer, you start at I minus and you go to I plus. If you're a null person, you come in from scry minus and you go back out to scry plus. So you're not really reflecting there. You're just going through R equals zero. So that is emphasizing that these diagrams are two-dimensional because we're ignoring theta and phi. So in this case, we've got an SO3 symmetry, which means that we don't really need, you know, our theta and phi just give us two spheres, completely nice round two spheres that go sort of live above each point on that picture. So that's the principle of the Penrose diagram. So now what I'd like to do is to talk a bit more about black holes, but to talk about the rotating black hole, which is called the Kerr solution. Right, so that is the Kerr metric. So let's just kind of look at it. This is in so-called Boyer-Lindquist coordinates. And what we see is that the rotation is encoded in this A parameter. So J is the angular momentum of the black hole. And so A is really talking about our sort of angular velocity, in a sense. So if we look at it and we see, well, where do we, you know, where does this A come in? So our Schwarzschild potential would have been, previously, it was the thing multiplying dt squared, which was 1 minus 2gm on r. So now, if we look at what multiplies dt squared, it's sort of quite similar looking, but instead of 2gm on r, we've got 2gm r on the sigma function, which now has a theta dependence. So that turns out to be quite important in terms of the sort of physical structure of the black hole. So it's not so obvious, you know, what's kind of going on here with the GTT part. What we do expect, though, is we expect if something is rotating, then if we go reverse our time, we look backwards in time, we don't expect to get the same metric because it's rotating. So if we kind of did either a time reversal or a parity transformation, it should go in the opposite direction. And so we see that quite clearly here with a dt d phi part of the metric and the a coming in. So that's kind of telling us that we've got this rotation, these mixed components. That also, I wrote this second line because here we've grouped together the terms. It's not the only way you can do this, but it's one way of grouping together the terms in a way that's maybe more familiar, or you can sort of draw, sort of walk back towards Schwarzschild. So here we've got, instead of dt squared, we've got a dt with a bit of d phi if a is non-zero. So this is now suggesting that maybe to look at our generalization of the Schwarzschild potential, it's either delta or delta over sigma. Out here, we've got our sine squared theta. So remember, if we had a two-sphere metric, we'd have sine squared theta d phi squared. And we haven't quite got d phi squared. We've got this a, we've got a sort of mix a dt. We're sort of mixing again the t and the phi. And now we've got r squared plus a squared there. And I believe we need that for it not to go crazy at infinity. So our metric functions now depend on both r and theta. And that kind of makes sense, because if we're rotating, we might expect things now not to look the same as we come off the equatorial plane. So let's have a look at what's going on with this metric and try and identify interesting features with it. So clearly, when delta goes to zero, we have, if I look at the second row, we have this prefactor of this time-like, generally time-like one form, tending to zero. Also, as delta goes to zero, the dr squared part of the metric blows up. So this is very like our v going to zero in our original Schwarzschild metric. So that's one part, or one surface, where something might happen. Then the other place that something interesting might happen is where GTT goes to zero. So previously, we sort of said, well, GTT goes to zero was our event horizon. But it's not so clear here what the event horizon is. So interesting surfaces, let me call it that. Okay, so here's one problem surface. We've got a singularity, suspect it to coordinate singularity as delta goes to zero. So as delta goes to zero, we have to take the roots of that quadratic, defines delta. And so we get two roots now. We've got two roots of this quadratic, gm plus or minus the square root of g squared m squared minus a squared. So that tells us we've got two of these surfaces, and it's the outer one that we're going to hit first. Then we want to look at gtt tends to zero. So what this is going to correspond to is the norm, if you like, of the time-like, you know, observer at infinity is just sort of sitting at fixed r, so their tangent vector is d by dt. So it's like saying the norm of that goes to zero. So this is also a quadratic equation for r, but now it has some theta dependence. So I have to take the outer root here, because that's the first one that we hit. So if I look at the outer root of that quadratic, I see that this is actually bigger than or equal to the outer root of delta equals zero, and it's equal to at theta is naught and pi. So what does this mean physically if we look at our metric? If gtt is zero, then that's saying that this vector d by dt is a null vector. But what that means is that if you, as an observer, were wanting to stay at rest relative to infinity, then you would be wanting, if you're at rest relative to infinity, that means your r isn't changing, your theta isn't changing, and your phi isn't changing. In other words, your tangent vector is proportional to d by dt. Now, if that d by dt is gradually becoming a null vector, that means that you're having to go faster and faster just to remain at rest relative to infinity. And once it hits zero, you can't do it anymore because only a photon can travel at the speed of light, and a graviton. So what this says is that if you lie between r plus and re, you're in that range. You cannot remain at rest relative to infinity. In other words, d by dt is space-like in that region. So then we have to ask ourselves, what is the event horizon? Is the event horizon delta equals zero or gtt equals zero? And if it's gtt equals zero, what's happening at delta equals zero? So that's really the question that we're going to kind of work around for the last little sort of portion of the lecture. So what I want to do is I want to look at geodesics in the Kerr space-time, but I'm going to do it in a very very simple case, because actually geodesics in Kerr are quite interesting. They're quite complicated. And lots of fun, which is why it's actually quite hard when you want to do black hole physics and you want to think about what does the black hole look like. That means when you say what does something look like, it means you're watching it, you're seeing light rays coming from it. which means you have to ask, how do the light rays get here? So that in itself is actually quite a complicated question, and quite a fun one. So you have to do that usually numerically. So we're doing it on the blackboard, so we're going to make our life easy. So just like you do with the Schwarzschild black hole, we're going to look at the equatorial plane. The difference, of course, is that with Schwarzschild, every plane is an equatorial plane through the black hole. Here, there's only one equatorial plane. But we're going to look at that because that's going to make things a lot easier. So just to recall, if we have a killing vector and a geodesic, we have conserved quantities. So we have a conserved quantity if we take a killing vector and dot it with the tangent vector of a geodesic. And the reason is that if we look at our simply taking the derivative of that combination, then the first term, the derivative of k, vanishes because it's symmetrized, and that's the condition of a killing vector. And the second piece vanishes because we're in a geodesic. So with Schwarzschild, what you would have seen is that you would have just had a conserved angular momentum, which would have been r squared phi dot, and you would have had a conserved energy, which would have been the redshifted t dot. So it would have been vt dot. With Kerr, we've got two killing vectors. The metric doesn't depend on t and it doesn't depend on phi. So we've got a kt and a k phi. So if we look at k is d by dt, that gives us a conserved energy. So that's simply we take gt mu dotted with the tangent vector. So at theta equals pi on 2, things simplify a lot. And you see that our energy now is a combination of t dot and phi dot. So this is kind of beginning to give us a clue that maybe gtt tends to 0 isn't necessarily the right place to look for an event horizon, because our energy is not just related to t dot. So the same expression for the phi killing vector. Oops, not R plus. So our angular momentum is primarily r squared phi dot. Certainly it is at large r, but as we get closer to the black hole, we see that the sort of potential multiplying the phi dot is a bit different, and we've also got a little bit of t. So now I'm going to kind of just think of my coordinates, if you like, in two pairs of two, or I guess since theta's really just going along for the ride, a one and a two. So I'm going to split off the t phi part of the metric, and I'm going to define, if you like, a momentum vector that's conserved, which is a composite of the energy and the angular momentum. Okay, so let me take the sort of length, if you like, that p vector. So that p squared is equal, actually, just to the t, the sort of length of the tangent vector, or the contribution of the length of the tangent vector from the t phi components. And then if you plug in what GTT and GT phi and G phi phi are in the equatorial plane, you get this expression here. So I've kind of massaged it a little bit to pull together factors that are kind of relevant. So we've got our energy squared, our angular momentum squared, and then we've got this bit in the middle, this mixed term that's kind of the one that is going to differentiate between geodesics that are co-rotating with the black hole and counter-rotating. So this, if you like, is your first insight into how things are different for the Kerr black hole, because obviously it's rotating in a particular direction, and you as an observer, you have the choice of whether you go in the same direction or the opposite direction. And so you kind of, you are the H, the black hole is the A. So you can kind of see there that whether you're going with it or against it, you get something different. So our geodesic equation, since we have all these conserved quantities, the only real variable is r. So the geodesic equation can be written simply in terms of a nonlinear first-order differential equation, which is just the length of the tangent vector. And that's equal to 1 for a time-like geodesic and 0 for a null geodesic. And so this is the sort of more familiar way of thinking about what the solutions are. In terms of an effective potential. So it's quite a convenient way of finding out what this, what sort of solutions you've got without actually solving the geodesic equation. You look at this so-called effective potential, which is obviously eta times 1 over GRR and P squared. So I'm just, you've probably seen this for Schwarzschild, but I just wanted to kind of try and split it up in the same way. Your effective potential usually has something that's like a Newtonian piece, a 2mnr piece. Then you have your sort of centrifugal type of thing, something that you, a contribution to your orbital motion, which depends on your angular momentum. And so here, this is being modified by the rotation of the black hole. And then the final bit, which is the bit that's usually associated to general relativity, that's the 1nr cubed term. Notice that's where this is dependent on which way, whether you're co-rotating and or counter-rotating. So if you thought about it, actually, you might have thought initially, well, why doesn't that come in with the centrifugal force? And the fact is that the reason it should, or the reason it's going to make a difference whether you're co- and counter-rotating is because the black hole rotating itself kind of drags your, the space-time with it, so-called frame-dragging effect. And so you wouldn't, so therefore it can't crop up. This distinction between co- and counter-rotating can't crop up till you get to GR, because that's an inherent geometrical Einstein-type effect. So we have our classic, let's just sketch our effective potential, sort of looking something like this. We get circular orbits. We can have a circular orbit, which means R dot is zero. So we can get a circular orbit at stationary points of our effective potential. So here I'm plotting it for eta equals 1. And so our actual zero of the potential sort of depends on E. So these are circular orbits. Here we've sort of got our 1 over r bit being dominant. This is our repulsive 1 over r squared being dominant. And then this is our attractive gr 1 over r cubed. So the reason it's useful to derive this effective potential is that we typically characterize the accretion disk of a black hole. That's, so the accretion disk is just a set of matter in orbit around the black hole. It has a typical, and I know it doesn't look like this, but I'm just trying to sketch it. It's usually largely confined to an equatorial plane, and we can approximate it by a set of co-rotating time-like geodesics. And so the accretion disk has a sharp cutoff at the point where it's the last possible stable circular orbit. And this is called ISCO, standing for innermost stable circular orbit. So we have a circular orbit at V equals V primed equals zero, because we have to have R dot and R double dot vanishing. And then if V double primed is greater than zero, it's stable. And correspondingly less than zero, it's unstable. And so V double prime drops as we move in, as our orbit radius drops. And so this innermost stable circular orbit is the last point at which you have V and V prime being zero and V double prime being just marginally positive. So our ISCO is V equals V primed equals V double primed equals zero. So, for example, Schwarzschild doing it because it's easier. So we've got three relations, and if I look here, I've got the radius of the orbit is unknown, H is unknown, and E is unknown. So these three relations allow me to solve for E, R, and H, and thereby we find R is 6gm, so I'll leave the details of that derivation to you, but it's reasonably straightforward. And so for Schwarzschild, the innermost stable circular orbit is at 6gm. So R ISCO drops with rotation, and actually it tends to It actually touches this R plus as we go to what is called an extremal limit. So I'm over time. So I'm not, I think I should just wrap up now, but just to make a sort of statement, what this is showing, because we can have these co-rotating orbits that are not sort of at least immediately, the only reason they get pulled into the black hole is because they actually lose energy, because it's a very sort of extreme environment and all this matter's being jostled and there's a lot of a lot of emission of light from the accretion disk. So what this is showing is that delta equals zero is the appropriate event horizon. And if I look at A tends to GM, I get a sort of limit of how fast the black hole can rotate. If A is bigger than GM, I don't have an event horizon. And so we call that the extremal limit. And so what you can do is you can look at the equation of motion for a light ray in the extremal limit. It's easier to do. And you can see that indeed a light ray can escape from, or just marginally from, that surface R equals R plus. So you can confirm that that is indeed the correct expression for the event horizon. And just one final piece of nomenclature is that this GTT equals zero surface is called the ergosphere, which is the limit at which you can remain still with respect to infinity. That's just the other piece of notation.